Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. The reviews are in for last week's episode, and it turns out it was a stinker. Oh, not many compliments on last week's episode, and that's fine. I said it was no good at the time. But this week, we are packed full. Packed full this week. I think this one will salvage the situation. So do stay with us. We've got later on, I'll be doing a top 10 countdown of leading non-players through the years. And we've also got your emails to come. Of course, it's quite a barren time at the moment. We're waiting for things to pick up again. I do have to say this, though. You know, if you observe some of the sort of chat around it, you'd think snooker was in an unprecedented crisis. I mean, complete nonsense. There's actually a lot of snooker coming up. We're just waiting for it. If you look at the calendar of the season, then there might be some events added to it. There's 15 ranking events. 12 of those are open to the whole tour. There's three that have limited fields. Everyone can get in them, but they're the player series events. Everyone can get in them, but they are obviously your limited fields. And then you've got, if you're a top player, so say you're Ronnie O'Sullivan, you've got the Masters, you've got the Champion of Champions, you've got the Invitation Championship League, you've got the Hong Kong Masters, you've got the Mixed Doubles. Now, obviously, you know, that's at the top end of the game. At the bottom end of the game, everyone would like more tournaments. There may be some added to the schedule later on in the season. We know what the problem is. Of course, it's China still, the uncertainty around COVID. And we don't know when those tournaments will be coming back. Now, you know, you can say, well, World Snooker haven't sort of explored other markets properly, but actually it would have been a dereliction of duty not to have gone to China with all that money on offer. It would have been ridiculous to have turned it down. So they were right to do that, and I'm sure that everyone would love to return there at some point. But, you know, the game is not suddenly on its knees. That's nonsense. It was on its knees when Barry Hearn took over. There were only 6 ranking events then. There are still 15 now. I think the most we had was 19 or maybe 20. That's not including all the PTCs and the sort of minor ranking events. But so, yes, there's fewer events. That's not good news. But it's not like we're down to single figures again. Players say, oh, well, you know, it's 3 weeks or it's 6 weeks to my next match. Well, that's because you just lost in a qualifier. I do feel personally qualifiers should be played nearer the main events. I do believe that. And actually, I quite like the Home Nations when you started with all the players at the venue because it was a level playing field as such. Problem with that, of course, is, you know, you need big venues and, you know, most of the places they play, there isn't room for example, enough practice tables and so on, and it is a bit crowded. But I think some of the lower-ranked players need a reality check, frankly, because the complaints about, for example, the mixed doubles, people have said, oh, that should be for everyone on the tour. No, it shouldn't, actually, because it wasn't a choice between having a 128-player event and an 8-player event. It was a choice between having an 8-player event and nothing. Same with the Hong Kong tournament. That wasn't a choice between having a ranking event and an invitation event. It was a choice between having an invitation event and nothing. And the fact is, the top players drive the interest. That's why they're on the posters. That's why they're on the TV table. They're the best players. They entertain. They're the players people want to watch. They, in some ways, carry the tour. And also, there's a misunderstanding amongst a lot of players about how their profession, which is what it is, or what it's supposed to be, how their sport is funded. It's funded through three main ways. One is ticket sales, one is sponsorship, but overwhelmingly the main way is broadcast fees that they get from the broadcasters that run into the millions. Okay? How do those broadcast fees get funded? Well, for commercial television, it's through advertising. Okay? Advertising revenue is at its highest when more people are watching. They can charge more for the adverts. And in snooker, more people are watching when the top players are playing. So that is how it works. It's all driven by not just the sport, but by the actual personalities playing. So the top players drive the wealth. Of course, they pocket a lot of the wealth as well, but that's because they win the tournaments. So when people say every event should be for everyone, I'm sorry, that the economics don't work out. It's supply and demand, you know? I would have more invitation events personally, not instead of ranking tournaments, but I think what they do in the PDC darts, they have the World Series where they go to various countries just for a couple of days. That would be a great way of spreading the word. It's what Barry Hearn did with Matchroom and other promoters have done over the years. take a small number of players to different parts of the globe, try and grow the interest, and eventually you might have a ranking event there, but you don't start with a ranking tournament. That's just my take on it. I think some of the chat around this, I understand people, obviously, you know, they want to play and they want to earn money, but I think people have to also be a little bit realistic and also sort of take stock of things a little bit. Because of the 15 ranking events on the tour now, only three of them existed when Barry Hearn took over, okay? Or were on the tour then. The British Open obviously had been there, but had been dropped. 2010, the only ranking events that were going then that are going now, the World Championship, the UK Championship, and the Welsh Open, every other tournament he has introduced, or his team have introduced, onto the tour in that time. So that, I think, deserves actually a lot of gratitude and a kind of acceptance that things have turned around. And let's not forget who was running the sport in 2010, the players, who only just accepted Barry's plan to take over. So, look, hopefully in a few weeks' time, when we get into the thick of the season, all this sort of chat will go away. But anyway, that's how the land lies at the moment. And as I say, coming up later, we've got a top 10 countdown. But before that, a huge feature coming up. It's moderately sized, let's put it that way. So I've had an email from Paul Wilson. Now, he's our man in Fiji, who I think single-handedly was keeping this podcast at the top of their rankings for a while. He said, it was great to hear Dave Tindall's snooker music doubles pairings based on birthdays. This was last week, of course. But he left out the 22nd of August, the birthday of Steve Davis. And Steve Davis. Surely the winning pairing. Of course, Steve, a player, but also now has become, a musician. As Paul says, in all seriousness, I think what Steve Davis is doing with the Utopia Strong is fascinating. I just got my hands on their latest album and I think it's wonderful. An interesting bloke indeed. Thanks again for the podcast. It's always a pleasure to see a new episode pop up in my feed. Thank you, Paul, in Fiji. Well, this sparked off some thoughts for me because snooker has a longer history of music than you might think. Oh, it does. We'll get to some of the big beasts of this later, but there's been a few players down the years who have dabbled in music. You wouldn't describe all of it as music, but they've done their best, put it that way. And I thought we would revisit a few of the efforts down the years. You think of the great songwriters of our time, you know, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney, Carole King, Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Peter Devlin. These people have really entertained us over the years with their lyrics and their music. And snooker players have attempted to do similar. And we start with actually Alex Higgins. Okay, now Alex Higgins, you might think, well, was he a singer? Well, not really, as it turned out. But he did his best. And of course, 1982, he won, as we know, the World Championship. So was very much in demand and all sorts of, you know, appearances and whatever. And someone had the idea, Alex, you should make a record. He made a record. It was called 147. Yes, it was. And I'm now going to play you a little bit of Alex Higgins singing 147.
One little red, one a black, then another red with just a little screw back. Choke on the tip, now I'm going to whip that top up with a black.
Now, the first thing you'll notice about 147 is it's no good. It's not any good, but, you know, it was the 80s, and there was a certain novelty value to all of this. A little more from Alan. Of course, for years, footballers had released sort of official records around the FA Cup final and the World Cup and so on. It never really happened in snooker. You know, you didn't get John Spencer turning up at the 1978 World Championship with a record, but Alex, in many ways, broke the mould, and, let's listen to him now, breaking the mould.
Could have been the element, hurricane's the pill that won't go for little ones, Jack. I'm a-telling you, wouldn't settle for a two when I see my way through to the black. 147, that's my idea of heaven. Gotta keep trying, keep my plan somehow.
That'll do, I think, for 147. Yes, it's an acquired taste, and not one that I've acquired, to be perfectly honest. By the way, I can only play 30 seconds of these without having to pay anybody. But anyway, but here's the thing about, 147. The B-side of 147 was called Life's in the Pocket, okay? And Life's in the Pocket is actually pretty good. don't take my word for it. Here's Alex Higgins singing Life's in the Pocket. It's 80s already, isn't it? That sounds like the 80s.
It's in the bag. If you don't let your problems become a drag, just treat those bills like a game.
Now, clearly, Alex, you know, he's not got the best voice. He's doing his best, and good luck to him. But it's I think that's as an early 80s kind of pop song. I think that's all right. Let's add a little bit more.
And play it cool like a friend. Your safety shot is to screw up the lot. Life's in the pocket, baby. It's in the bag.
I'm saying that's not too bad. I'm saying that's not too bad. And it didn't end there for Alex Higgins, because he later, a few years later, he released a record, 1986, The Wanderer. Now, this was a well-known song, but they rewrote the lyrics, or somebody did. And the group was called Four Away, and the four were Alex, Tony Knowles, Kirk Stevens and Jimmy White. There's a quiet night. There's a quiet night out. You can just imagine them ticking off the Ten Commandments one by one, can't you, the night out, those four. But anyway, they released this cover version. I mean, it is terrible, it's got to be said. And again, don't just take my word for it.
Well, I'm the type of guy who likes to number nothing. I'm never in one place. I go from town to town. When they ask me, I like to play the best. I set up all the rules and I take on all the rest. Yes, I'm the one.
Now, this was 1986, and of course, this is sort of the Snooker's version of Blur versus Oasis, because the other song in 1986 that everyone will remember was, of course, The Matchroom Mob, featuring Chaz and Dave, Snooker Lupia. This is the high watermark. This is the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band of the snooker music crossover genre. Chaz and Dave, it's worth saying this, okay, this was a novelty record, but they were not a novelty act. They came from quite a long tradition of sort of the working class music from London, the sort of Cockney music that was played in pubs and was part of the sort of culture that obviously has not disappeared, but it's not as mainstream as it once was. And they obviously, I'm so excited to cue this up that I've just pressed the wrong button there. They were very much a very popular double act, Chaz and Dave. They have some lovely songs, actually. But it's all in the tradition, this sort of Cockney music tradition of, you know, that scene they came from, if you like. Now, Snooker Loopy, I'm sure a lot of people know this song. And if you don't, well, here's your chance.
Snooker Loopy, nuts are we, me and him and him and me. We'll show you what we can do with a load of fools and a snooker cue. Pop the wrist in, screw back for the yellow ring, down blue, pink and black.
Now that clapping you can hear there, that's taken from a live performance on Top of the Pops, although it seemed only Chaz and Dave were live, because the players were not there. I don't know where they were, but let's listen now to Dennis Taylor singing his line.
Never ever got why the old my boggles, and nowadays he talks a lot because I wear these goggles.
Because I wear these goggles. They managed to find a rhyme for boggles with goggles, and you've got to respect that. Of course, Dennis was on there, Tony Meo, Terry Griffiths, Willie Thorne, his hair's all gone, and Steve Davis. And of course, at the end, Barry Hearn appears, and the whole thing is Barry don't care who wins this year because he's got the rest of us signed up. The only problem with that is it was 1986. They hadn't got Joe Johnson signed up. He did win the World Championship. They signed Dennis, but Joe Johnson won it. Snooker Loopy reached number 6 in the UK singles chart, just after the 1986 World Championship ended, in fact. And I've actually got the top 10 here, okay? So it got as high as number 6, it had been at 11, went up to number 6. So this was the top 10, okay? Just to give you a flavour, those of you who don't remember the time, These were the 10 records in the top 10, and it's fair to say there's something for everyone here, except possibly music fans. But anyway, number 10, Live to Tell, Madonna. Not one of her best, and I don't apologise for liking Madonna. They're not one of her best songs. Number 9, Rolling Home, Status Quo. I don't remember that one at all. Number 8, Why Can't This Be Love, Van Halen. I think I actually bought that at the time. Number 7, Rock Me Amadeus, Falco. So there's, again, a bit of a novelty song. That had been number 1, I think. Number 6 is Snooker Loopy. Number 5, Spirit in the Sky, Doctor and the Medics. That was a big hit, a big cover version. Number 4, this was a proper song, Sledgehammer, Peter Gabriel. They had that extraordinary video, sort of stop motion video that it took weeks to make. Peter Gabriel, one of the kind of more literate pop stars of the time. Number 3, Lessons in Love, Level 42. That's a very, very 80s band. Number 2 is an excruciating song, On My Own, Patti LaBelle and Michael McDonald. If I never hear that again, it's too soon. And number 1, and this was the time we were living in, number 1 was the Chicken song, Spitting Image, which was, which again was a novelty record. It was a sort of a pastiche of the sort of summer holiday records, I suppose, and Brits going off to Spain on the holidays. I think I bought that as well, because when you're a kid, you think that stuff's hilarious. Stick a deck chair up your nose and pretend your name is Keith. I seem to remember that was one of the lyrics. But in amongst all of that sat Snooker Loopy. The problem, of course, with having a success is you have to have a follow-up. And the follow-up to the Matchroom Mob was, the Snooker Loopy song, was the ill-fated Romford Rap. This did not trouble the chart scorers and indeed ended the career of the Matchroom Mob. As singers by now, they had... It wasn't just the 5 from Snooker Loopy. They drafted in 3 more players because Barry had signed 3 more players. So we had Neil Folds, Jimmy White, and actually 2 more players. Yeah, so there was 7 of them. Neil Folds and Jimmy White joined in. I'm not blaming them for ruining the what could have been a great musical career. We don't know, but the Romford Rap wasn't as good as Snooker Loopy. That was the problem.
He's Tony, he's Steve, he's Neil, he's Jim, he's Terry, he's Dan, he's Willie. We're going to do the Romford Rap for you, though you might think it's silly. But believe you me, it's how they all talk snooker in the Matchroom Club. It's rhyme, it's slang. Come on, everybody, all pin back your love.
So essentially, the story here is they're going to treat you to rhyming slang, essentially, again, from the sort of the Cockney... culture, you know, the rhyming slang, and there's a few examples of it within the song. So like Snooker Loopy, Snooker Loopy was educational because it told you the order of the colours, and pop the red, screw back for the yellow, green, brown, blue, pink and black. And this is a different sort of education, a little more.
Now to start the game, upon the cane, there's 22 Google calls. For those of you that are confused, there's 22 snooker balls. Now 15 of them are newlyweds, then you got the old rubber kite. Newlyweds, well, they're the red, and the rubber kite's all white.
That's enough, I can't listen to any more. Well, I suppose we've got to have the chorus, haven't we? We've got to have the chorus, so here goes.
It's the Romford Rap, the Romford Rap. Open up your trap and give me some of that. Whether you're a Paddy or a Tabby or a John or a Jeff, whether you're yellow, green, brown, blue, pink or black, from Christian Bow or North with a Watford cap, you can do the Romford Rap.
Now those lyrics, I think these days might be frowned on, but this was the 80s, anything went, and the Romford Rap is not looked back on fondly, I don't think. Certainly not by music lovers. But anyway, it was inevitable there'd be a follow-up, but that was it. The video's strange because there must have been some concept to film a sort of pop video on a big snooker table sort of set. But the video actually is them filming the video. It's like behind the scenes. So it suggests that whatever they had planned didn't quite work. Of course, Steve Davis, as we know, has gone on to a more sort of, authentic, is that the word? Credible music career, maybe. The others don't seem to have continued the old music. But one man who did, listen to this.
This is Joe's alternative career. Occasional lead singer with
Joe
a group Johnson, made in Japan.
That Joe Johnson singing never lasted long. I missed the trick because what a voice. I think that documentary's, they followed him around, obviously after we won in 86, ready for the 87 championship. And, then that, yeah, that's, it's all there. It's all there. Now, we if we're going to talk about singing, I don't think he ever released a record. Well, in fact, I know he didn't. But Dominic Dale, oh, what a voice on him. He, of course, is a big fan of the old opera. Well, when he won the Shanghai Masters in 2008, he sat down in the press conference, and this is the bomb he dropped.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain.
That'll do, Dom. Yes, I mean, what a voice. What a voice. A big fan of Mario Lanza, I know, Dominic. And, that was his sort of tribute. Well, not to him so much as Frank Sinatra. But anyway, he'll do that at the drop of a hat, by the way. If you see Dominic in the street and ask him, he won't mind. He'll sing. He's not shy. But for our next snooker player, pop star, we had to wait for Peter Ebdon. Peter Ebdon released I Am a Clown in 1996. This was a David Cassidy cover. It didn't, I don't think it necessarily hit the top of the charts, but one thing with Peter, he's got a good voice, unlike some of the other people we've heard in this feature. So he did I'm a Clown, and then the next follow-up song, it was called The Fall of Paradise, which turned out to be quite an apposite title for the song, because it marked the end of his singing career. This was the last one he did, and it's quite a, well, I think the word for this I would use is earnest.
I opened my eyes and I saw your love had turned away from me. Now where could I go? When a heart that was believing turned again.
So earnest is the word I would use for that, and heartfelt. I don't know what sort of style that you'd compare that to. Maybe Richard Marx. There's one for the teenagers, Richard Marx. A little more.
One day I could see.
That's enough, I think. So it's been a while since Peter did that. That was the 90s. The time has moved on. But we now have, as I say, an authentic pop star, because Steve Davis, the Utopia Strong, is an electronic sort of outfit. And, you know, it's not for everyone, clearly, but it is a type of music that has a big following. And Steve and the band have played in various places, including Glastonbury. And, you know, Steve has taken it seriously. That's what I like about it. It's not a joke. He's serious about it. He's as serious about his music career as he was about his snooker career, and I really respect that. So this is a track called Shepherdess by the Utopia Strong. Now, I'm expecting a catchy chorus here in the middle 80s. I'm not going to get it. It's not that sort of thing. We get the picture there. So that's the Utopia Strong. So it's come full circle from Steve Davis appearing on the most famous of all the snooker records, Snooker Loopy, to now actually being a legitimate music recording artiste in his own right. And as I say, good luck to him. I don't know where any of that got us, really, but I hope you enjoyed a little trip down the snooker memory lane. Snooker Loopy will always be, I think, at the top of the shot, but I am going to give another shout for Life's in the Pocket by Alex Higgins, because I do feel that that's a little bit of an underrated gem. It was a B-side, but it was, well, I thought it was pretty good. In fact, let's have a little bit more of Life's in the Pocket.
Your winning streak's just ahead. If you attack, it's right on to the blind. Life's in the pocket, baby, it's in the box. Life's full of chances, so wait for your breaks.
That'll do, I think. So anyway, that's snooker and music. Bedfellows, sometimes awkward, But when it's good, it's really good. And it hasn't been really good very often. But now and again, as with Life's in the Pocket, magic happens. Now, change of tack, emails. Gary Park has written. He says, thanks again for the continuing high quality of the podcast. It remains engaging, entertaining and thought-provoking, and I look forward to downloading it every Monday. I did wonder if Gary had sent this to the wrong person, but anyway, it is for me, because he carries on. I don't know if you're still in the market for suggestions for a best of variety, and if not, then please just ignore and delete this one. I'm sure that preparing such episodes takes up a disproportionate amount of time, and far more than the hour or so of broadcasting. Well, you'd be surprised, actually. Not really, but anyway. How about an episode, he says, that features the individuals who are not best known as players and have contributed much to snooker's development and popularity, such as broadcasters, managers, refs, journalists, promoters, coaches, etc. I don't suppose a contemplation of these people lends itself to a top 10 format, but it would be great to hear someone with your snooker hinterland reflect on the unsung heroes and heroines who are not mentioned often when the history of the game is discussed. Well, I thought this was a great idea, Gary, and I'm actually going to do a top 10. So this essentially is going to be my own personal top 10 of people who, let's say, are not best known as players but have contributed to snooker. Now, I say not best known as players. There are a couple of people who have been professionals in this, but they're not best known as players. So, for example, Rex Williams is not in it. Rex Williams was best known as a player. His role off table as chairman of the WPBSA, in fact, he set up the WPBSA, he rescued the World Championship, all of that. Unfortunately, he can't make this top 10 because he was best known as a player. That's a fact he was. But someone like, and he's not in this list, but an example would be Jack Carnham, okay? Jack Carnham was a player, but he's better known as a commentator actually billiards player, more than snooker maybe, but he made Dennis Taylor glasses, all of that stuff. But he would be an example of someone who would qualify. So there are a couple of people who play professionally, but they're better known for other things. This is a personal list. I've tried to not make it too repetitious. So there are a couple of people in who, for example, there's a coach in it who I guess represents all coaches in a way. But anyway, let's just do it. It's all, again, a bit of fun and hopefully informative enough. So number 10 is 10 to 1. This is the top 10 people who have contributed massively to snooker who are not predominantly known as players, okay? Number 10, Sir David Attenborough. Now, there'll be people saying, hang on, I know he's a national treasure, but what's he doing on this list? Very simple. David Attenborough put snooker on television. He was controller of BBC Two when it was set up in the 1960s. Snooker had been on TV here and there in the black and white era, basically a sort of filler on grandstand. You'd have sort of Joe and Fred Davis standing by. You know, it was racing at Newbury. We need 15 minutes of snooker to fill the gap between the races. So often Joe and Fred would essentially contrive a frame to last, you know, that long. There was no integrity hotline in those days. They did what they wanted in black and white times. It was obviously, you know, quite hard to follow on black and white. And it's also true when colour came in, you know, it took a while for people to get colour TV. Not everyone had them. It wasn't available all over the country. But anyway, one of the ways that David Attenborough, one of the ideas he had to promote the colour service was to have something colourful on it. And snooker fitted the bill as a sport, obviously with the coloured balls. It's got a perfect playing surface. You can fit it all into one camera. So he commissioned Pot Black. And it was that decision that led to everything we have now. It led to the professional circuit. All the memories we have of TV snooker started with Sir David Attenborough as controller of BBC Two, commissioning Pot Black, and we have many things to thank him for, but that is certainly, if you're a snooker fan, that's right near the very top of the list. Number 9, I've gone for John Parris, the cue maker. It's a bit of a sort of standing joke at the end of tournaments. He puts a picture on Twitter of him and the player who he's manufactured the cue for, but he has been at the forefront of cue manufacturing for several decades now. And so many players swear by his cues. There must be something in that. They know best, after all. Ronnie O'Sullivan has used Parris cues for years. And it's a terrific story, actually, I think, his sort of his cue-making history. It's a reassuringly sort of old-school profession, I think, cue-making. It's all, you know, hand-done. John Parris and his team, they sort of go to the timber yard, they get the ash and the maple, and they know what they're looking for, it's all very bespoke, and if you've ever seen sort of video of it, or even been to his sort of shop and seen it happen, it's a fascinating process. So John Parris, and there are other cue makers, and I'm not in any way dissing them at all, but it's definitely he is at the top of the shop when it comes to cue making. And you know, I quite look forward to seeing his pictures at the end of finals, because it's just a sort of reaffirmation of the status he has in the sport, that that people want to use his cues, and he's still going strong, as I say, 30 years on. Number eight. Now, this is someone, a name that people may not know, but Anne Yates was tournament director for many years for the WPBSA. And in a way, in this list, she represents not only herself, but also the officials of the sport, the referees, the people who, the staff who keep the tournaments ticking over. But she was an important figure because she is actually the only woman on this top 10. Professional snooker has been a very male-dominated industry. That's changed in more recent times, but certainly looking back over its history, it's just a fact, it's been male-dominated. But Anne was, you know, the sort of number one at tournaments in terms of the officials for years. And she ran snooker in a very professional way, a very strict way. You didn't mess with her, you know. She was very much on the ball with everything. She took no messing from players. They all respected her because she was sort of firm but fair. And this was in the eye of the storm. This was in, you know, the mid-80s when snooker was ruling the TV airwaves in Britain, where there was a lot of focus, a lot of scrutiny on it. She would be protective of players. She would make sure, you know, they were looked after. But she would also make sure, and this is the important thing, I think, that there was discipline, you know, that people actually, in as much as was possible, behaved professionally, because it was professional sport and we were projecting out to the world, this is our product that we want you to spend your time and your money on, so we need to be professional. And I think actually she was very important in that, and she also kept some of the officials in line as well. There's been other people who've done that job, obviously now Mike Gamby, and Martin Clark and Paul Collier, but Anne sort of set the standards in that role. And I think sort of behind the scenes at tournaments, you always knew that she was, you know, in charge, and that's quite important, I think, particularly, as I say, at that time when, you know, snooker was sort of front page news. So I think that she's retired now, but I think she deserves recognition for, you know, that work that she put in. Number seven, I've gone for Frank Callan. Frank was often described as the sort of father of modern coaching. He was a fishmonger from Blackpool who became a snooker coach, very well respected. The fact that he worked with Steve Davis and Stephen Hendry at various times obviously tells you, you know, how important he was to them, and how important he was to the sport. He played snooker when he was young. I mean, he's born in 1923, so obviously snooker wasn't really on the radar much, but he sort of drifted back into it in his 20s, and he played in the sort of Blackpool area at a certain league standard without necessarily, you know, ever threatening to turn professional. But he became interested in coaching, and he sort of based his coaching very much on the Joe Davis kind of ideas, but also had his own ideas. So he sort of took what was already there, and I think he felt that the sort of original ideas out of place snooker didn't work for everybody. So he developed his own methods. He had the drill, which was a certain sort of way of addressing the ball. I think you would always know a player who'd been coached by Frank Callan, and even though he wasn't the top player himself, I think people understood that he understood the mechanics of how to play snooker. You look at Doug Mountjoy in the 1980s. His career was declining. He went to see Frank Callan, who rebuilt his game, and Doug Mountjoy won the UK Championship and then the next ranking event, the Mercantile Classic. And he said, quite memorably after the UK final, he pointed at Frank Callan and he said, "Without that guy, I'm nothing." So it told you that, you know, it really had a massive impact on just the way that he played. Like I said, Terry Griffiths, John Parrott were coached by him as well. And certainly when Stephen Hendry won his seventh world title, Frank Callan was in his corner then, and it definitely, you know, helped sort of get the spark back into his game. He passed away a few years ago, but was universally respected in the sport. And of course, as I say, now there are other coaches and other methods as well that, you know, it's not one size fits all. Different methods and different approaches work for different players. I don't think Frank Callan was massively into the psychology of snooker so much. His was a technical coaching, and I think one of the things that he kind of believed was that different players had to find different sort of things to work for them. But anyway, he definitely had a big part to play in the careers of several players. Number six, I'm going to say Nick Hunter. Now, he was the BBC's producer when snooker sort of moved from Pot Black, which was a weekly programme, to actually coverage of the tournaments. And Nick Hunter really led the way in terms of how snooker on the BBC in particular was produced and how it looked to viewers. And really, the template that he set is still the one used today in terms of camera angles. I mean, things have changed a little bit in terms of that, but in terms of the kind of the basics of it, how you cover snooker, how the programs look, he set those standards. He was the one who kind of ran it again, from what I've heard, pretty much with a rod of iron, but I suppose you had to. But helped make snooker what it was on TV. And as I say, migrating from having a weekly magazine, Pot Black, which is essentially a sort of exhibition, really, to actually the proper tournament snooker that really is about snooker competing with other sports. Nick Hunter was the producer, as I say, of those programmes, and he worked out in the north of England, which I think is actually significant. I don't know the exact sort of how it all worked, but I think there's something to be said for having a kind of enclave away from sort of London and that whole kind of environment there. Just being allowed to get on with it, really, I suppose, and come up with, you know, because they were inventing, these guys in the 70s essentially were inventing the way that sport on TV worked. And as I say, it's amazing when you look at all sports now, you can see the basics that are still there. Things have moved on in a lot of sports, but the sort of essential groundwork that was laid by people like Nick Hunter is still there. And when it comes as well, not just to the look of the tournaments, but the sort of formats as well, what works best for TV, just ideas like going into the arena and doing interviews there, and just the sort of the whole sort of aesthetics of it. All that was kind of laid down back in the day, and he was very significant in making those decisions. Number five, and this man has to be on the list because he invented snooker, Colonel Neville Chamberlain, although he wasn't a colonel at the time. This is going back to 1875, Jubbulpore, India, all of that, the UT Club. I think people know the story. It was the British Army officers based in India. It was the rainy season. They were indoors. There were other sort of Q sports that they played. They started essentially messing around with them and developed a new sport, which came to be known as snooker. Snooker, the word is believed to have been a kind of insult that they would use for junior officers, which makes you wonder what the sport could have been called, actually. But here's the thing about Neville Chamberlain, though. At the time, he was only 19. So he was very young. Now, I suspect, obviously, that other people played a part, but he was the man who was kind of credited with coming up with the essential rules of snooker, many of which still apply to this day. And, in fact, in 2022, it's 147 years since snooker was invented, which seems the ideal number, doesn't it? John Roberts was the man who then brought snooker from India to Britain. He was a billiards champion and a promoter, and he was responsible for sort of popularising it in Britain. But it started in India. Dennis Taylor's been to the UG Club. He told me he filmed a thing. I think it was the Real Marigold Hotel with sort of older celebrities, and they're in India. And he sort of trekked up to the UG Club. I think it took a while to get there, but he said he felt very emotional. Obviously, I can't swear it's the same table, but the fact to be in that club, he played a frame on a table in the club where snooker was invented, or where the rules were invented anyway. So, you know, that's quite something. And, you know, from those humble beginnings, obviously Dennis, you know, more than anyone, I think would appreciate having potted the most famous ball in history, just where the game was kind of led from. Thank goodness it rained, you know. If it hadn't rained, who knows, this podcast wouldn't exist. What a tragedy that would be. Number four, Ted Lowe. Now, Ted Lowe, obviously, someone put a picture up. Our friends at Bayswatch, the Twitter account, put a thing up last week, Ted Lowe at the Crucible, and it reminded me that when he retired, he was a BBC commentator, Ted Lowe, for many years. When he retired, a few years afterwards, I wrote a piece about him, and he actually, this is old school stuff, he sent me a handwritten letter of thanks. Now, these days, you'd be lucky to get a tweet, but he sent me a handwritten letter of thanks. He was a snooker enthusiast at a time when not everyone was a snooker enthusiast. He was the general manager of Leicester Square Hall, where they had so many big snooker matches, exhibitions and world finals and so on. So he was a big friend of Joe Davis, really liked the sport, and did his best for many years to try and get snooker properly on television. Of course, he became a commentator. There was a commentator who used to do sort of most sports, Raymond Glendenning, great name of the past. Sort of person Harry Enfield would sort of impersonate on his sketch show. And he lost his voice. So Ted had to do a match one time from the audience. So he had to whisper, hence he became Whispering Ted Lowe. And but he was a great, passionate sort of supporter of snooker, tried to get it on TV. He sort of came up with Pot Black, really, put together the sort of the rules and picked the players for a number of years, commentated on it. So he was there at the start of that revolution. And, of course, for many years was a very popular commentator, had a lovely voice, lovely manner about him. I think there's an argument whether that style would work now, whether people expect something different now, but it worked then. And, you know, people loved Ted Lowe, and he was there on so many great moments on the BBC, you know, the 85 final I mentioned already. But, yeah, he was a great figure in the sport. He was... There's no... I mean, obviously, the commentators now, many of them are players, so they're sort of remembered as players, but he was... as famous as many of the players back in the day. And, you know, you always felt it was, I don't know, this is sort of nostalgia maybe taking over, but I always feel if I hear his voice now, it takes me back. You sort of sat, you know, with your nan next to the fire. It's Sunday afternoon, the snooker's on, and all is right with the world. Now, I know that's a very romantic, rose-tinted view of the past, but actually, that's what I associate him with. And also, he wouldn't sign an autograph for my mother. So that's to his credit as well. Now, number three, Mike Watterson. Now, Mike Watterson was a player, a professional player, but he's best known as a promoter. He, I think, saw the possibilities for snooker in the 1970s, obviously with the BBC and ITV starting to become involved. And he saw the opportunities to really start to develop a professional circuit, which is what the sport needed. The demand was there to see snooker, but it had to be meaningful. Therefore, you needed tournaments. Now, we only really had the World Championship initially. Mike Watterson was promoting that, and he took it from a series of what had been not really suitable venues to the Crucible. Now, the sort of the story that's always told is that his wife Carol had been to see a play at the Crucible Theatre, which hadn't been open that long, and said to him, I know you're looking for a venue for the World Championship. Maybe you should check out this place. It might be ideal for you. Mike went and looked at it, found that it only just about had enough room, but anyway, tried it, and, well, the rest is history, of course. It's something very special to be remembered for, I think. What a legacy to have, to be the man who took snooker to the Crucible. But it wasn't only that. He did a lot of other things as well, which are important. He instituted new events to meet the demand of television. So, for example, the UK Championship was an opportunity brought in. Things like the World Team Cup, the World Doubles, all these sort of things were his ideas, working with the broadcasters to understand what they wanted. Someone like Nick Hunter, he would have worked with very closely. And he was very successful. And, of course, what happened was the WPBC at the time thought he was too successful, so they took it all off him. There's always been this thing in snooker, you know, a sort of resentment for people making money. Obviously, Mike was a businessman, and he wanted to, you know, run a business. But the point is, if he was making money, so were other people. But the snooker lot thought he was making too much, so they thought, we'll have that off you. And I know that he was, you know, all his life really upset by that. But, as I say, his legacy is assured. Not just the Crucible, but his other activities as well. Set the building blocks for the circuit as we know it now. Understanding that you need different formats. Don't make every event the same frame length, for example. And as I say, working with broadcasters to understand what they wanted. So Mike Watterson very much earns his place on this list. We've got two to go. So number two on the top 10, sort of non-snooker players who've made a contribution to the game, is Clive Everton. Now, I can be accused of bias, obviously, here, because Clive is the editor of Snooker Scene. However, having said that, the new issue, the September issue, is actually going to be the last. Clive, he's not in the best state of health. He's 85 this week. And he's written about this in the magazine himself, but it's a harsh realities of the world. The financial realities is that the snooker scene really, because it's never been a massive profit-making operation, he's done it for the love of the sport, but it's now in a position where it can't really survive. So after 51 years, Clive has taken the decision to close the magazine down, which is obviously very difficult for him. But what a contribution, because here's the thing, okay, now we have all these wonderful sources of information. Q-Tracker would be one of them, Crucible Almanac. But neither of those would exist without snooker scene, because for years, in the pre-internet age, snooker scene was, its primary contribution was that it provided a living history of the sport. All the frame scores, all the information about tournaments, junior events, you know, you would see so many reports of, you know, 11-year-old Ronnie O'Sullivan won this junior event, or you know, 10-year-old Judd Trump, or, you know, 8-year-old Paul Hunter, whoever. And then obviously you follow their careers through. And all of that is there, and it's a great resource, stretching, as I say, over half a century, cataloguing snooker on the table. But also, the other sort of primary purpose of it was to catalogue what was happening off the table. And the snooker started to become successful, and money came into it. You then had certain issues around the administration. Clive fought many battles over the years trying to professionalise that side of snooker as well, and I think it took a bit of an emotional toll for him, but he kept going. And you know, 51 years editing every issue is an extraordinary achievement. We worked out that apparently it was only Clive and Hugh Hefner of Playboy who had edited the magazine that long, and you know, they're very similar magazines, obviously. I don't know whether Hugh Hefner has that much interest in billiards, but anyway, Clive kept plugging away and plugging away and plugging away, and really devoted his whole life to snooker. Obviously known very widely as a commentator, a journalist. He was for years really the only journalist in snooker in the early years. He passionately believed it should be reported in the media. Quite often he was fobbed off and told no one's interested, but of course people became interested through television, and he was therefore well placed then to become a very popular voice on television, on radio. The Voice of Snooker became known as. He's the best writer the sport's ever had, I think, and everyone has their own opinions on commentary, but for me he's the absolute gold standard when it comes to really saying what needs to be said and no more. He would never talk for the sake of it. A bit like Richie Beno in cricket, when he spoke, it was worth hearing. Has such a great vocabulary that he was able to crystallise his thoughts and not waste a word. And a great source of inspiration to me, certainly. So, Clive, through his journalism, through snooker scene, through television, has made an enormous contribution. But also, a lot of people don't know, for example, he founded the IBSF, the amateur body. The Masters exists because of Clive, because he was, for some reason, in the 1970s, he was managing Jonah Barrington, who was the Britain's leading squash player at the time. And anyway, he had sponsorship from one of the tobacco companies, and the account was handled by Peter West and Patrick Nally. They ran their own agency. Peter West, who was known as a broadcaster, cricket presenter, and he presented the old Come Dancing before it became Strictly Come Dancing. Anyway, they had lunch with Clive one day, and they said we're handling an account for Gallagher's, who own the Benson Hedges brand, and they're interested in sort of coming into sport more, and have you got any ideas? And Clive essentially came up with the idea for the Masters, having an elite event in London. And 1975, there we were, it all began. So, but lots of things he's done behind the scenes that got involved in things that maybe people don't know about, and just the great sort of evangelist for the sport, really. You know, he would bleed snooker, I think, and billiards. It's important to mention his love of that as well. It's probably actually as a player more his sport, but snooker has a lot to thank him for. And ironically, from snooker scene's perspective, the sort of the way the game's become more professional and more successful in recent times, in the end, sort of made taken with the obviously the internet as well, kind of made snooker scene's initial kind of two purposes a little bit redundant, because suddenly, in terms of the matches and the scores, you could find that out online, and the politics, it's not completely gone away, but it's receded massively, because the changes that were made more recently were what Clive campaigned for. So he kind of, in the end, got what he wanted, I suppose, at the cost maybe of the magazine itself. Anyway, Clive is number two, and number one, I think, can only be Barry Hearn. What an extraordinary contribution he's made to our sport. As a manager, of course. I mean, initially, Barry was a snooker club owner. He bought a chain of clubs. He was a chartered accountant, bought a chain of clubs in the 1970s before the boom. One day, Steve Davis walked in, and again, it's one of those Lennon meeting McCartney moments, isn't it? It's one of those incredible moments where people come together, different types of people. Barry, an extrovert. Steve, an introvert. Both talented. Steve on the table, Barry off the table. And then when snooker made it big in the 80s, and it made it big partly because of Steve Davis. I mentioned last week about how he brought a respectable audience and middle-class audience and all of that, and therefore sponsorship and families and women and all the rest of it, children, to snooker. Barry Hearn was well-placed to exploit that. He became the first person, really, to exploit snooker's commercial possibilities. And again, a bit like Mike Watterson, you know, people thought he was making too much money. They became jealous of the fact that his tournaments were successful, and there was a sort of battle for who was really in control of snooker. He drifted away a little bit at the end of the 80s into the 90s. He got into other sports and had passion for boxing and football, and, you know, ended up making poker big and ten-pin bowling, fishing, all these sort of niche activities that nevertheless have a lot of fans. He's the genius at packaging things, Barry. Obviously, darts is probably the ultimate achievement, really. Getting like 10,000 people in for a Premier League match. And I think the reason is he's just an ordinary working class bloke. He knows what ordinary working class people like. They want a nice night out to enjoy themselves. He doesn't need a focus group to tell him what ordinary people want, because he is an ordinary person. He knows what people want, and that's essentially the genius of Barry. And often he knows it before they do. That's the other thing. Obviously, he came back into snooker when it was struggling badly towards the sort of the second half of the first decade of the millennium, has revolutionised things quite significantly. I mentioned all the tournaments that he introduced. Obviously, you know, there's still challenges, and those have to be met. But Barry Hearn has contributed so much to the sport, and has just got that great personality, that great sort of drive that I think we need. He always seems to be upbeat about stuff. He's always talking up what he's doing, but also talking up the sports that he represents. And he's a bit of an inspirational figure, I think. I mean, all the guys at Matchroom have come along in his wake, you know, just have so much respect for him and so much love for him. And thank goodness he got involved again, because he has really made a difference to the lives of many people. So that's it. That's the top 10. I'm sure I've left people off. There'll be people screaming at the their audio listening devices saying, what about so-and-so? But that is my list. And do, of course, feel free to let me know yours. Now let's move on to the other emails. You see, a lot of people would say, that's enough already, we don't need more, but you're going to get more, whether you want it or not. Sam Cole. I'm another one of those long-time listener, first-time correspondent types. I have a lot of opinions on snooker, as it's the only sport I follow, so I'll save some for when you have another quiet week, i.e. next week. Anyway, he says, firstly, thank you for continuing your excellent podcast. You may not always realise it on a week where you only get a few emails, or indeed a week where you delete all of the ones you actually get. But hundreds, probably thousands, of people look forward to hearing your voice and opinions every week. Thank you, Sam. He says, during the recent European Masters, I found myself wondering, who actually is Philip Studd? Other non-player commentators, such as yourself and Phil Yates, are known to fans through means such as your podcast, Snooker Scene, Work for World Snooker presenting roles, or indeed WST videos where you're walking round Leicester. Yes, I'm still recovering from that, actually. He said, but however, I realised I know very little about Mr. Studd, who he is, where he fits into the snooker world. I was thinking an episode where you're joined by Philip and other Eurosport colleagues to discuss another countdown or ranking of certain players' titles would be a nice idea, especially having a Phil seems to be a fashionable thing among snooker podcasts these days. Another thing I thought of, a few years ago, BBC did a series of interviews with the players to ask them which player they thought was best at certain attributes of the game. They called it My Perfect Player. The videos mentioned cue power, safety play, tactical play, cue ball control, cue action, temperament, bottle, rest play, and long potting. There may have been others. This is something I'd love to hear you discuss, either on your own, with my fellow listeners, or with your colleagues. Thanks for taking the time to read my email. You'll be glad to know there's plenty more where that came from. Goodbye, bye. Well, thank you, Sam. I am glad to know there's plenty more that came from. The Perfect Player thing, I'm sure I have a memory that I did this a couple of years ago, in a previous iteration. But anyway, in terms of Philip Studd, well, yeah, he's been a broadcaster for many years. He worked at Radio 5 Live as a general broadcaster. You would hear him on the sports desks and reporting from various events. But he was a big snooker fan back in the day, growing up, play snooker as well. And he became their snooker correspondent. So for many years, he was at the big events reporting on snooker for 5 Live. And then eventually, the sports department at the BBC was made to go to Salford. And I don't think, because Phil had a family in Essex, I don't think he wanted to actually move to Salford. So he left the BBC, went freelance, and, you know, hawked his wares, as all freelancers do. And eventually, there was an opening at Eurosport, and he's been doing that for about eight years now, I think, or something like that. He'd obviously know for sure. But, yeah, so that's essentially who he is. And, you know, very, very professional operator. And, as I say, a proper snooker fan. Now, I like this next one from James Watson, because this is, it's both niche and pedantic. And if nothing else, this podcast is niche and pedantic. So James says, one slight niggle I always have when I hear it is the top-bottom cushion debate. I think I've finally found the ultimate solution. When a colour is potted and all available spots are covered, the rules state the ball must be replaced as close to its own spot as possible, below it. This always means moving it in the direction of the black cushion or the top cushion, as people refer to it. But surely this is incorrect if it's the top cushion. It should move closer to the ball cushion or the bottom of the table. So either the balls are being replaced incorrectly, or finally we can settle on the black cushion being the bottom of the table. Love to get your thoughts on this. Hope it made sense to you, as much sense to you as it does in my head. Well, it's a good point, as I say, niche and pedantic, that's what we like. It's just, I mean, it is a bit confusing, because when you see a snooker table on television, obviously what we call the top cushion, the black cushion, is at the bottom of the screen. I tend to call the bulk cushion, if you like, I tend to call it the back cushion, which is probably wrong as well. But I suppose if you call that the back cushion, if you say black cushion for the top cushion, that could be confusing, because they sound the same. I'm really glad I started on this. Yes, but I suppose when you're standing to break off, you're looking up the table and the cushion at the top of the table is the black cushion. But I get your point. Niche and pedantic, keep them coming on that score. Adam Fisher. He says, it seems like your letter bag is as dry as Europe's lakes, not to mention the snooker calendar at the moment. So here's another question. See, people are just taking pity on me now. That's fine. He says, what's the furthest distance a cue ball has travelled during a single frame of snooker? I'm guessing a contender for this record is the world's longest frame between Dave Gilbert and Fergal O'Brien. I roughly worked this out as being between a third to half a mile. On the flip side, what's the shortest distance a cue ball has travelled during a single frame? Thanks to David Grace also for answering those questions last week. Top guy on a top podcast. Yes, David answered some questions on brushing and ironing the table. Yes, well, I suppose the longest frame, which is 2 hours, 3 minutes, you would think that would be a candidate for the longest distance. But, I mean, there's absolutely no stats on this. I mean, there just isn't. But the shortest distance, I might be able to answer this, actually. Shortest distance during a single frame, because I commentated a couple of years ago at the Championship League in Leicester on a frame, I think it was between Barry Hawkins and Ryan Day, and there was a re-rack after two shots. Literally two shots were played and they re-racked. So how many frames of snooker has there been where the cue ball has travelled a shorter distance than that? So I reckon that could be the answer, but as I say, there's no official stats on any of that. Angela Beattie. I'm really enjoying the podcast, especially the short-lived twice-weekly ones too. I was saddened to hear the podcast received 3 emails last week, although very good ones, so much better quality over quantity. I felt I should send in my contribution, even if it's a bland one. Following on from the... it's not bland at all, by the way. Following on from the revelation that Belinda Carlisle and Kirk Stevens share the same birthday, and you share a birthday with Neil Tennant, I thought I would share mine. I share a birthday with Chris Wakelin, who was born on the 16th of March. Because of this, I'm a fan of his, and take a keen interest in his career so far. I noticed There seems to be a fair number of snooker players born in March. I originally counted 22 until I noticed a lot of them have since dropped off the main tour. On the current ranking list, I counted 15 players born in March. Chris Wakelin is in good company with Luca Brasel, Mark Williams, Steve Maguire, Robert Milkins, Ryan Day, Scott Donaldson, and the famous Fergal O'Brien too. Keep up the good work, Angela says. Thank you, Angela. Well, Chris Wakelin, now, this is interesting you mentioned him, because I was asked by our dear friends at World Snooker Tour to, a group of us, Neil Folds was one, I think Michael McMullen was another, they asked us to predict the season ahead and, you know, star player and all this, that and the other, and who could break through from down the ranks and do something. And I went for Chris. Now, that in snooker terms is like the kiss of death. I've jinxed plenty of people, nothing personal against him. I went for him because he's in that sort of middle-ranking position. He's clearly a good player. He produced some good performances on television, actually. He's the sort of player who could break through. It might not specifically be him, but somebody from around that position in the rankings, the sort of 50 in the world, between sort of 40 and 60 in the world, 50-ish in the world, will probably do something. It'll be someone who'll come through and have a good run in a tournament. And why not him? Well, why not him? It's because I've tipped him, of course. There was a prediction thing a few years ago that Eurosport did with all the commentators. Well, it was World Snooker did it, but with all the Eurosport commentators around Europe, a season-long thing we had to predict winners of tournaments. And I had a shocking time of it. In fact, I would have been last, but for Mark Selby winning the World Championship, who I tipped that year. It wasn't a glorious period in my career, let's put it that way. But hopefully Chris, despite those disadvantages, can do something this season. Now, Callum Law. So I've been enjoying the podcast over the summer. Great listening as usual. He didn't say it's this podcast you've been listening to. It might be that John Sopel thing with Emily Maitlis that's all over the side of buses. But anyway, he says, I found the discussion around this season schedule and the gaps in it very interesting. You mentioned last week the idea of reviving some old PDC events. In my view, this season and next season, if China is still out of bounds, then staging some of these smaller events would be a reasonable alternative. With a bit of planning, you could potentially play three or four of these events in the space of a fortnight and try to grow the interest in the game in new areas. Although cost of staging may be an issue, it would be good to see maybe a four-event swing in four cities in mainland Europe, the same in North America, and the same in the UK and Ireland. I know not everyone was in love with the PDC events, but I always thought they served a good purpose, offering players opportunities to play for reasonable prize money and ranking points, while also taking the game to new areas. In PDC darts, they have the equivalent of PTC events on the calendar. While there are 10 or 12 major televised tournaments across the year, the PDC stays between 20 and 30 Pro Tour Players Championship events, which are open to all tour players with decent prize money and ranking points on offer. In the short to medium term, snooker going down a similar route with some smaller ranked tournaments could be the way to go. Another point linked to the schedule is that less events may make it more difficult for younger players to progress in the game. For new pros, the first few years are generally a learning curve, but if players are able to play in 20 or so ranking events, they gain more experience and should become better equipped at an earlier stage to survive on tour right now when there are less tournaments and it may be harder for new players to break through. Apologies for the lengthy email. Be interested in your thoughts. Well, nothing. Don't apologise, Callum. Well thought out. I think it makes sense. The issue always is money, okay? It's going to cost money to put these on. Even a sort of so-called small event, you need a venue, you've got to pay the referees, you've got to pay people to make it happen. The table fitters, everybody, the venue is going to probably going to have to pay to go somewhere. Snooker doesn't have a permanent venue. I mean, this is something that they looked at years ago, 25 years ago, and didn't do. And I think the initial outlay would have been a lot, but we would have really saved a lot of money over the years if we actually, as a sport, owned the venue where you could go and play qualifiers and go and play these sort of PTC events. You could stream them, betting firms and so on. I'm sure you'd make money back. They drag out the qualifiers for that very reason. So I think what you say has merit, and it would certainly, I think, keep some of the lower-ranked players happier because they'd be playing, which is what they want to do. I don't disagree with you, but I suspect, as with most things, I suspect ultimately the sort of issue in the end is money. That's something that you can't sort of magically, I guess, wave away. Alpha Bonzi. I can't remember whether I read this out last week. And this is, again, a great sort of illustration of how hard I prepare for these podcasts. I don't think I did, so I'm going to read it out. It says, like you and fellow correspondent Kelly Barker, I share the feeling that snooker has stagnated in the last few months. There's no buzz about the sport right now. It's a real shame that China is in no hurry to bring its tournaments back and snooker hasn't penetrated it or has lost its footing in Gibraltar and other markets. Hopefully my three quick questions will try and lighten the gloom. Number one, can World Snooker use the upcoming women's event in the US to get an event on there themselves? Why don't I answer these in turn, okay? So to answer that, well, I mean, certainly it can't hurt. Obviously, that event was played in a snooker club, a really nice one, the Ox Billiards Club. That probably wouldn't be appropriate, though, for a TV tournament in the professional game. You'd need actually a venue where you can have, you know, proper seating and all that stuff. So they would need to find somewhere. So that club in Seattle is clearly a really important sort of part of the thread, but it probably isn't the place where you would play a professional event. And also, again, a professional event would cost a lot of money. But I know they're looking at America. It's not impossible that that could happen. It would be brilliant if it did, obviously. Number two, how come Matchroom can only promote two tournaments despite being owners of World Snooker? You and another correspondent said if Matchroom took over the running of, say, the Shootout, the event would come off better, and I agree, even if the Shootout isn't my thing. That's in the contract. They can only promote two tournaments because that was the contract that was signed when Matchroom took over the running of World Snooker. Now, as Phil Yates said to me the other day, if they suddenly promoted a third event, what would they do? Sue themselves? I do get that side of it, but the fact is that is what is stipulated at the moment. And number three, Alpha's last question. Even if it's a little strange that the players have to be in a bubble whilst allowing up to 8,000 spectators to attend, how big of a needed jolt could the Hong Kong tournament send through the game? A great opportunity to display the sport in its best light on an international stage. Completely agree, Alpha. I think that tournament's going to be really good, and it's going to be really good because it is just eight players. This is the point I was making earlier. It doesn't have to be a ranking event to showcase the sport. Nobody turns off the Masters because it's not a ranking event. You know, that tournament could, I think it's going to be potentially one of the highlights of the season, actually. I think I'm really looking forward to that, and it will be on Eurosport and indeed Discovery Plus, the excellent streaming service. Martin Eccles, he says, you spoke about the Nugget last week, that's Steve Davis, of course. He says, I remember David Vine saying this after the 1989 finals. This is when he beat John Parrott 18-3. He said, if John Parrott is number two on the world ranking list, the gap between him and the rest of the players compared to Steve is absolutely massive. How wrong was he? Martin says. Plus, I live in Ireland. We could have staged an event in this barren time. Well, you could, Martin, but again, you know, someone would have had to have paid for it. I mean, this is the thing, you haven't talked about this, but Goffs, of course, where they used to have the Irish Masters. That was a fantastic venue, but it was a fantastic one-table venue. You wouldn't take a ranking event to Goffs and have four tables. So if they were going to bring back a tournament in Ireland, the old Irish Masters, which was for 12 players, that sort of thing would be perfect. But, you know, then you'd have the complaints that, you know, it's for the top players again. But anyway, thank you for your... I don't remember David Vine saying that personally. By the way, we should mention, as you mentioned David Vine, I should mention... Talking Snooker podcast with Hazel Irvin last week, which was fantastic. Really enjoyable. Hazel is the main presenter on the BBC for those outside Britain. And she's been doing the job now for almost as long as David Vine. I think Vine started in 78, finished in 2000. Hazel, I think, began in 2001. So where are we now? 2022. So yeah, next year it will be actually 22 years, same as Viney did. I'll say this about Hazel, okay? When you achieve a position, and not just in broadcasting, anything, where you are kind of at the top of the tree, you are in some ways given license, if you want to not behave that well, because you can get away with it. And if you give people a chance to get away with not sort of behaving properly, a lot of them will take it. And we see this with certain sports people, we see it with punditry. People may remember Richard Keys and Andy Gray at Sky. Didn't exactly end well for them there because of their sort of behaviour. But Hazel is the opposite of that. Hazel is the nicest person in the world. She's ultimate professional and a great team player and sees herself, and she said this on the podcast, she sees herself as part of a team, not at the head of it. And she has done a wonderful job for the BBC and for snooker as well. We've been lucky to have her. In some ways, she sort of represents the kind of the best values of the BBC in terms of its public service broadcasting remit. She, as far as I know, has never gone freelance and worked for other channels. I've only ever seen her since she joined the BBC on the BBC. She's brilliant at the multi-sport games, like the Olympics, Commonwealth Games, moving from one sport to another. So much of it is her professionalism and her enthusiasm still for doing it. She doesn't take it for granted. She certainly doesn't act big for her boots. And apologies if I've told this story before, but years ago when I was a journalist, before I started doing commentary, I was, well, I can tell you when it was. It was 2006, because it was the World Championship that Graham Dott won. I was at the Crucible in Sheffield, writing for the Sportsman newspaper, which was a short-lived betting newspaper. It didn't last very long, but it was in operation while the World Championship was on. I was their snooker correspondent, and they wanted snooker content. And I saw Hazel in the morning. She came in the press room, as she often would do. And I said, "Would it be possible to interview you for the newspaper?" She said, "Oh, no problem." She said, "I'll come down later on when I'm on air at 1 o'clock till six, so 5 hours. I'll come and find you after that." Now this was 11:30, so. You know, it's 11:30 in the morning, she's on air at 1, she's off at 6, I'll come and find you later. Now, I'll be honest, most people, if they said that, that's actually just code for, I'm not going to be doing it. And I'll just say, I've forgotten if you see me later. But I swear, at 6:10, in she walked. She'd finished the programme, you know, had a brief chat with the producer, come straight to the press room to find me to do the interview. How classy is that? And did a great interview. And, you know, you don't forget things like that, because she didn't have to. I was a journalist. I could have, you know, interviewed anyone, I suppose. That could be the attitude, but it wasn't. The attitude was, he's asked me, I've said yes, and even though I've done a long broadcast and I may prefer to go back to the hotel and have a meal and a drink and relax, I'm going to do what I agreed to do. And God bless Hazel, she's brilliant, and I'm glad that she's continuing in that role, because it's good for the game, definitely. Now we have another Irish correspondent, John Doran. He says, "I've enjoyed your ranking of World Championship wins for Ronnie O'Sullivan, Stephen Hendry and Steve Davis. I think your ranking for Davis' wins were absolutely spot on. The only quibble I had with any of your rankings was the relatively low ranking for Ronnie O'Sullivan's 2020 win. I would have ranked that one much higher. He had to play very well and fight hard to win tough matches against Ding Junhui in round two, Mark Williams quarterfinals and Mark Selby semi-finals. Surely his semi-final win against Selby, having to win the last three frames and the way he did it, is one of his greatest ever wins. But that's not what I'm writing about." Well, just on that, John, I think the 2020 World Championship, I just associate that with being, because it was behind closed doors, it was in August, just a bit of a weird tournament. It's not sort of the great sort of April-May World Championship. I mean, I was glad it was on, obviously, delighted it was on, but I just associate it with being a bit kind of weird. So maybe that's why it was low down, but I take your points. Anyway, he says, "Two things have been on my mind. The first relates to the current lull in the calendar. I think opportunities are being lost to have snooker on TV during these breaks in the calendar. It should be possible to have a series of short tournaments during this period." This is kind of building or similar to what I said, and also what Callum said earlier. But anyway, he says, "For example, there could be a series of two-day weekend tournaments with a small field of players. You could have eight players play over 2 days in relatively short format matches. Each such tournament could have a different set of eight players. Some criteria could be devised for choosing the players, e.g. players in lower rank brackets, local professionals, players in certain age brackets. It's been said before that there would not be an audience for such tournaments, but I don't think this is true. There might not be a large live audience, but there would definitely be a TV audience, or at least a streaming audience, as there is for the Championship League and for qualifying rounds of various tournaments that are streamed on Discovery. Snooker fans would enjoy it. I certainly would. Anyway, there doesn't have to be a large live audience. It looks bad on TV when there are a lot of empty seats, but the solution to that is to have fewer seats when you know there's not going to be a lot of spectators. In some of the pool tournaments, there's actually very few seats in the auditorium, and those are often filled with the players' family members and other players, and that's fine. Such events obviously couldn't be ranking tournaments, but lower-ranked players would have the opportunity to win real tournaments. In other sports, e.g. golf and tennis, there are many tournaments on tour that don't have the very top players competing. I find it hard to believe there's not ample scope for such relatively small events in locations such as Belgium and Dublin. Watching matches with lower-ranked players can be extremely interesting. The World Qualifiers are a viewing highlight of the year for me. It's partly because the stakes are so high for the players, but the stakes will be similarly high where lower-ranked players have a real chance of winning a trophy and some money. It doesn't have to just involve lower-ranked players. It's just that there are already a range of tournaments that are exclusive to the top players." So that's John's first point. And again, there's a lot of merit in it. But again, it does come down to, okay, yeah, fine, but someone's got to fund it. They've got to find the money. To pay the prize money, to pay the staging costs, and they do add up. So although what you say makes total sense, there would be a cost to it, and it's just whether World Snooker Tour feel that that's money they should be spending. The second point John makes, he says, the second thing on my mind relates to the women players on tour. First thing to say is I fully support having places on the tour for the top women players. I think it's great. However, it must be demoralising for the women to be struggling to the extent they are on the main tour. Both Ngan Yi and Mink Nuncharat have recently won matches against Ken Doherty and Mitchell Mann, respectively. I hope they build on their success, but I find it hard to see them winning many matches. Their break building during matches just isn't strong enough yet, and the matches tend to be more than a little attritional. My suggestion is that the women players should certainly continue on the main tour, but that there should be additional women's events hosted at the same time and venue as some of the main tour events. For example, imagine if there was a women's Masters tournament hosted at Ali Pali in the same week as at the Masters. Could be a short format event, perhaps using even six reds, involving, say, the top eight women players. The World Match Play Darts this year, there was a short format women's tournament on the final day, and I thought that worked really well. It didn't matter that the standard of play was considerably lower than in the main tournament. The event was competitive and the matches were exciting. It would surely be possible to devise something similar for a snooker tournament like the Masters. It would give a much greater profile to women's snooker than the events on the separate women's tour. Thank you, John, in Ireland. It's a good idea. They did, years ago, play the finals of women's tournaments at the professional events. So, for example, the Women's World Championship final was played at the Crucible, and that was a good idea. And, of course, with sort of streaming now as well, you could make more of it. I guess you have to strike a balance. I mean, the Women's Tour is a development tour as such to get players now through to the professional tour, so it's raison d'etre has changed. But in order for that tour to be competitive, you need people to be aware of it, and you need women and girls to be aware of it, so you need a certain profile. So definitely having those events more closely aligned with the professional events would work, but it's maybe not as simple as just saying, well, we'll just turn up and play our tournament as well, because there are things like, you know, again, it comes down to, okay, if you want to play, say, the women's matches in the morning, you know, you need to pay people to turn up and operate the venue and all that sort of stuff. And so it's not just a question of, okay, we can do this and it's not going to cost us money. And it's all everything in the end, you know, in professional sport, which is a business, comes down to money. But I do think there's definitely an opportunity. For example, some of the ITV tournaments on the Saturday afternoons, they don't have any snooker just because there's racing on ITV and there isn't the slot. The World Grand Prix, for example, on Saturday afternoon, there's no play. So there's an opportunity there to play a women's event. They actually played the English amateur final one year in Cheltenham, but they could play the final of a women's event as a showcase. So maybe not every tournament, but there's opportunities during the season maybe to do that. It's a good idea. I like the fact that our listeners, they care so much about snooker that they come up with these ideas. And I do hope that there are people sort of taking note of them. They're not all going to happen, but, you know, there are some good ideas here. So thank you very much for sending them in. Graham Jones, who describes himself as a passionate snooker fan, he says, thanks for the great podcast. Keep up the great work. I don't really understand the snooker world rankings. I know there are roughly 128 players on tour each season, and the top 64 on the two-year list from the previous season are automatically on the tour next season. But there aren't 64 new players on tour each season, so how does it work? I know there are various ways to get on tour, such as Q School, Q Tour Playoffs, various international amateur champions, some invitation tour players and so on, but this doesn't account for all 64. An explanation on this would be greatly appreciated. Well, you've basically got it, Graham. What you're forgetting, though, is, of course, there are certain players who are on the second year of a two-year card. So you've got the top 64 on the two-year list, but there are certain players who had only had one season on tour, so they continue the next year. So there's actually going to be more, that automatically is more than 64. So you've got the top 64, then you've got, there's actually 31 players who are on the second year of a two-year card. So that takes us up to 95. We've then got the top four from the one-year list, who were not kept their place at the two-year list. So there's four players who stayed on from the one-year list, and they're Ashley Hugill, Michael White, I think got back on that way, Alan Taylor and David Lilly. So that's another four. So that takes us to 99. Then there's the 12 Q School qualifiers. So that takes us to 111. There's four players who've come to the Q School in Asia Oceania, which played in Thailand. So that's 115. There's two players who've won World Snooker Federation events. Si Jawi won the World Championship. Anton Kazakov won the under 21. So that's 117, I think we're at. Two players from the Q Tour, Sean O'Sullivan and Julien Leclerc. So that's 119. Two players coming from the Women's Tour, Mink Nunc Jarat and Rebecca Kenner. So that's 121. There's a place awarded by the CBSA in China, Peng Yisong. So that's 123, I think. We've got two invitational tour cards, Stephen Hendry and Ken Doherty. So that's 125. And then there's various regional players who have been awarded a two-year card. So Oliver Brown won the European Championship, Dylan Emery, the European Under-21 Championship, Andrus Petrov, the European champion. Well, Oliver Brown won it the year before, but he didn't take his place up. Andrus Petrov, Ben Mertens, Ryan Thomason in Australia, Victor Sarkis in the Americas, and Mohamed Ibrahim in Africa. So they've all been, from various parts of the world, been awarded cards. So I make that 132 players. Now, I may have added, let me just add that up again. Okay, so we've got 64, 31, so that's 95, another 4, 99, another 12, 111, another 4, 115, another 2, 117, another 2, 119. This is riveting stuff, isn't it, this? Another 2, 121, 122 with China, 7 regional champions, 129. It's actually 131 because the invitational tour cards takes us 131. So that's essentially it. It's the top 64 on the two-year list, the players on the second year of a two-year card, the top four off the one-year list who are not on the two-year list, the 12 Q-School qualifiers, the four Asia Q-School qualifiers, two from the World Snooker Federation, two from the Q-Tour, two from the Women's Tour, one nominated by China, seven champions from around the world, and any international tour cards, there's two this year, takes us up to 131. And this gives the lie to people who say that the invitational tour cards are taking places from other people. They're clearly not. They're actually extra places, because the tour is supposed to be 128, but it's just gone over with those extra places. Hope that was instructional. I like to think we bounced back this week. I wait the reviews, but I like to think there was a lot in that episode. It was a long one, but hopefully worth ploughing through. any thoughts, of course, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's it for now, though. We're proud members, of course, of the Sports Social Network. Check out the other podcasts, and we will return next week for who knows what. Who knows what, but it'll involve snooker. I think we can guarantee that much. In the meantime, as we always say, goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.